Welcome to the Functional Medicine Podcast with Dr. McMinn and Coach Lindsay. We're coming to you from McMinn Clinic in Birmingham, Alabama, where Dr. McMinn is an integrative and functional MD, and Lindsay Matthews is a registered nurse and IIN certified health coach. In this podcast, we'll be discussing the latest information on a wide range of topics in the field of functional medicine, which looks for the root cause of disease, and integrative medicine, which incorporates both conventional and alternative therapies. Our overall goal is to help you be the best that you can be in mind, body, and spirit. The following discussion is for educational purposes only and is not intended to diagnose or treat any disease. Please do not apply any of this information without approval from your personal doctor. And now, on to the show with Dr. McMinn and Coach Lindsay.
Welcome back to the Functional Medicine Podcast. This is your host, Dr. McMinn from McMinn Clinic in Birmingham, Alabama, a functional and integrative medical clinic where we get to the root cause of your concerns. I'm here with registered nurse, certified health coach, and co-host Lindsay Matthews. So, Coach, what do we have on tap today for our listeners?
Yes, thank you. We are super excited to introduce our guest today. She is Dr. Christine Locken, PhD, from right here in the Magic City. She's both an academic and also a clinical neuropsychologist. And we're going to pick her brain today about brain health. Dr. Locken currently practices at the Birmingham VA Medical Center, and a couple years ago, she opened up a cutting-edge functional medicine clinic along with our very own Dr. McMinn, taking a root cause and functional holistic approach to neurocognitive issues, and that clinic is called the Brain Health Institute here in Birmingham. Y'all heard me right. Birmingham,
that's
Alabama.
Right. That's
we
right.
have our own Brain Health Institute. So welcome to the show, Dr. Locken. We're so glad to have you.
Thank you so much, Lindsay. I am just truly, truly excited to be here. I'm so excited that you guys are doing this podcast, and thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Dr. Locken, it's been such an honor to work with you over the last few years at the Brain Health Institute. I attended your TED Talk recently, and it was just wonderful. You're getting to be quite a media star. But as you kind of summarized our work at the Brain Health Institute, I just felt so proud of what we're doing over there. And I feel you and I have sort of the perfect synergy of talents and skills to really help our patients with brain health issues. But before we get into that any further, please tell us a little bit about your background, your training, some of your professional stops along the way, your current gig, and why you arrived at a functional approach to brain health.
Yeah, and I just want to, on the front end of that, say likewise. I am just so honored to work with you, and I think that there are just times in our lives when people are placed before us, things are placed before us, and that's what this whole venture has been. So as you said, I've been in academia for most of my career, but really started to feel uncomfortable with the diagnose and adios mentality of most neurological disorders, and fell into functional medicine and just found that there are so many other tools that we can use to treat these different types of things, or just to approach it differently. And no one else was doing it. So we just felt like we had to create it, and we did. And I'm just so excited to do that with you. So in terms of my background, it's kind of interesting how I came to functional medicine. I think it's just like the perfect marriage of my avocation, which is just a passion for health and wellness. And I've always had that. And then my vocation of neuropsychology have fused together, where inherently I kind of always knew that what we put in our bodies matters, how we move our bodies matters, sleep matters. And as a health psychologist, we talk about those types of things. But when I was back in graduate school, like 300 years ago, when I tried to do both health psychology and neuropsychology, most of my professors asked me, like, well, what does health have to do with neuro? And in my head, I'm thinking everything, and I just went ahead and pursued both of them. And now the literature is showing us that it definitely, has everything to do with it. And we're seeing some clinical randomized trials that are coming out saying that, if you do these things for neurological disorders, people can get better. The work of Dale Bredesen, those types of things. And so I think it's just been really interesting to find functional medicine where it's just kind of been working its way to this nexus of, everything that I've been interested in.
Great.
Beautiful. So we'll just kind of jump right into brain health. Why do you feel like it's so critical and so important that you've dedicated your life really to it?
I know, yeah. There is like a line in my TED Talk where I'm like, I think a lot about brain health. And I practiced in front of my kids way too many times. And they're like, yeah, understatement, Mom. Yeah, so yes, I think a lot about brain health. I think brain health is so very important. And I think the obvious, you know, our brain really is responsible for all of our functions. But when we think about, you know, the fear of aging, the fear of, you know, getting older, I think the biggest one is loss of our intellectual capacity, absolutely, loss of our independence, loss of our ability to drive, those types of things. And so even though brain health is important for just, you know, everyone at every stage, I think, you know, protecting our brain health so that we can remain as independent as possible for as long as possible as we age is probably the most important thing.
Mm, beautiful. And I think that's so important because a lot of times we don't think about that until it's, you know, we're in our 50s and 60s and then it's like, okay, now it's time to think about that.
Yeah.
But just to go ahead and be on the preventative side of things and be proactive.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's, you know, it's never too late. And what is that Chinese proverb? The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. The next best is right now.
Right now.
And so
right.
It's never too late. Mm-hmm. And even if, you know, someone is symptomatic and has, you know, memory problems, things like that, there are still things that we can do to have ease for both the caregiver and for the person. But the best thing is to be preventative. You know, it's much easier to get a hold of brain health issues or to prevent brain health issues than it is to really intervene when someone is symptomatic.
Beautiful. But I love that message of hope at the same time.
Because,
you know, so much of us, when we think about, well, it's just like a lottery, roll the dice, like it's in my family, hopefully I don't get it, that kind of thing. But what you guys are doing is really just empowering to people. Mm-hmm. You're bringing hope.
Yeah, and that's really the message that we wanted to bring. I think there's so much out there that is scare tactics, and it's taken conscious effort to stay away from that, you know, and to really come at it from, you know, a hopeful perspective. And I think there is hope. I think there really is hope, but not if we don't do something differently.
Right, right. So tell us a bit more specifically what kind of conditions y'all treat at the Brain Health Institute and who would a typical patient be?
Anyone with a brain would be good.
Yes.
Yeah. And actually currently we're only treating adults. However, I know both you and I have had pediatric populations. Yes. So I think that might be something in the future. So we really started out following the lead of Dr. Bredesen's work and started out with our memory clinic. And we started out, I think the people who responded most in the beginning were those that were symptomatic. But as we've followed this path over the last couple of years, then we started getting people who had more mild cognitive impairment or subjective cognitive impairment where they're not as sharp as they used to be, but they don't really meet criteria for any brain type of issue. And then now we're really attracting a lot more people for prevention. And those individuals look like a couple that has just retired in their 60s or 70s. And they, you know, they have worked their whole life for this moment. And they are scared to death that one or the other is going to get dementia. Maybe a family member of one or the other has had dementia. And so they want to do everything they can do to prevent. So they have this, you know, beautiful end of life together, which is probably going to be, you know, another 30, 40 years, who knows?
Right.
And then also we have had some children of people who have Alzheimer's disease or people who have discovered that they have the APOE4 allele, which we can talk about a little bit later, that they know that they're at high risk. And so they want to, you know, do everything they can to prevent because they've seen their family member go through it. So I think that's really, you know, our typical patient right now. And what we've done is to build out, and I think we're getting close to perfecting the memory disorders clinic and our prevention optimization clinic. But we can do so much more. I am at the VA as well on the traumatic, I'm the director of rehab neuropsychology there. And so I see a lot of traumatic brain injury. I think we can do a lot of these functional medicine principles for traumatic brain injury. We have a couple of patients in our traumatic brain injury and concussion clinic. We can also do things in terms of more holistic psychology. So those who are suffering with depression, anxiety, you know, if they want a different way and don't just want to look at, you know, medications that are going to be resolving symptoms but not resolving the underlying issue that's really leading to the depression. And then I've also trained with Dr. Terry Walls, who, if anyone out there has autoimmune disorder, I would really encourage you to look at her work, look at her book. But she uses a functional medicine approach to autoimmune disorders, specifically multiple sclerosis. But I think, again, you can apply it to most any autoimmune condition. And then the last thing that I really wanted to build out is having more of a mindful eating clinic. It's kind of interesting that all of our work right now is more in prevention of dementia, because all of my research that I've done was more on neurocorrelates of binge eating disorder and eating behavior. And the interesting part of functional medicine is that diet is such a huge component of that. And so if anyone has, you know, issues with like emotional eating or overeating, it's really hard to kind of stick with certain diets, things like that. And so getting, you know, at the root cause of those types of issues to help with, you know, following treatment programs or just, you know, getting in the right size body, you know, someone wanting to figure out kind of the thought behind the eating. And so I think those are, you know, that covers a lot of ground, but
really
I think at the end of the day, you're using a lot of the same principles, you know, that same foundation to treat these different types of patients.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. You know, Dr. Locken, as you know, I grew up with sort of a traditional Western medicine background, and I practiced that for many years until I finally became enlightened, and I use that with air quotes, and I discovered integrative and functional medicine. And certainly, the traditional medicine works very well for many patients. In fact, it saved my life, so I'm very grateful to it. But when it comes to brain health, it seems like there's a lot more to that than drugs and surgery. So explain to us sort of an integrative and functional approach to brain health and how it really kind of complements a traditional approach, if you can. If you have any examples, I'd love to hear some examples.
Yeah, and I'm kind of going back to more of the dementia issue, and unfortunately, there's not much to offer.
Yeah.
And so what I see in standard medical care is that's typically patients present way too late in the process because they don't know. And so you kind of wait until the memory problems are there. They will wait months for an appointment with a neurologist, and then they meet with the neurologist and there's nothing they can do other than offer a drug that really, you know, study after study has shown that they don't work. And in fact, there was a review study in 2017 of November saying that it's possible that they can actually make things worse. And so that's kind of what we are doing in traditional medicine right now. So I really feel like, even though I want to be a bridge with what, you know, people are doing with neurologists and what people are doing with conventional medicine, I think we really need to start offering more things. And so one of the things that we need to really understand is that there are different things that contribute to the speed and severity of the progression from normal cognition to Alzheimer's. And these things can be different for everyone. And it's not just one thing. Usually it's a bunch of different things. And so Dale Bredesen, who wrote The End of Alzheimer's, likens Alzheimer's disease to a roof with 36 leaky holes. And some of those holes are really small and pretty easy to plug, like vitamin D deficiency, you know?
Right.
And then some of these are really gaping holes, and they're different for everyone, but someone's gaping hole might be things that you guys have talked about with your listeners before. Gut health, you know, we need to fix that gut and plug that hole in your leaky roof. Or it might be metabolic syndrome, or it might be just really stress and poor sleep. And, you know, and so going through and kind of identifying which holes are leaking in that individual, start to plug those holes. And you don't even have to plug every single hole, just the bigger ones. And then, you know, after you plug a certain number, you get a shift. And that shift, you can have some stabilization in terms of decline of cognitive impairment. And in some cases, you can actually restore function, which is really a brand new concept.
It's so profound. And it brings me such joy when I see these people come back and they're actually better. Because without treatment, they would inevitably be worse.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And it's such a rewrite of the script, though, versus, you know, here's, go to the pharmacy, pick this one thing up.
Yeah.
You know, what you're talking about is this wide approach to, like you said, fixing all these different holes. But if you can reach that ratio of, like, if we can get just enough holes plugged, then you start seeing some results. And
exactly.
That can really help the patients just start to shift that perspective of, okay, this is a different approach. Because, you know, we've all grown up with this approach of, here's, you know, symptom pill, like you said, diagnose, adios.
Right, exactly. So. Yeah, and I don't, you know, I know that I was pretty negative about the current standard medical care. I think there is a place for medications, but I think that Alzheimer's is just too complex. Like, it's just too complex for one medicine, you know, now or, you know, what we find in 20 years. I think we're going to have to do a synergistic approach to get a hold of it.
It reminds me of the paradigm of energy. I think the most common complaint I hear in my practice is low energy or sometimes just profound fatigue. And unfortunately, there's no energy pill. You know, you have to look at all the things that cause low energy and the list goes on and on. So I think, you know, by just taking your time to go through them one by one and looking at what might apply to that patient, start plugging holes again, to use that analogy, then that's how you get people better. But there is no energy pill.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So when a patient comes to the clinic, Dr. Locken, what's the typical process for assessing them and figuring out what the leaks are?
Yeah, so Dr. McMinn and I definitely have two very complementary skill sets, and so we're able to offer more of a medical paradigm in addition to more of a neuropsych, which means I, you know a lot about like the cognitive issues. And then I'm also a psychologist, so I know a lot about like behavioral and, you know, just kind of psychological issues as well. And so our intake is pretty comprehensive for the patients that choose that route. So Dr. McMinn will meet with the patient, do a physical exam, and from that we can order some fancy lab testing. And all of that, we've really distilled it down, I think, to the heavy hitters in terms of it's more than what you would get from a standard medical lab work, by far more. But all of the things that we are ordering, we have, you know, oodles of scientific studies that show that they relate to brain health. And so we get a pretty comprehensive lab panel. And then I do a very comprehensive interview with the patient, and generally a family member or several family members come with them and go through kind of that bio, psychosocial background to really see what are the contributing factors. And sometimes, I mean, it's, you know, it seems not related, but trauma, like childhood trauma or military trauma. I mean, there are things that, you know, kind of contribute to stress, to sleep, to those types of things. Or it might be, you know, some different, you know, things that are going on in terms of like medical history, things like that. So we do a pretty comprehensive interview. And then we also do cognitive testing where we take a tour of someone's brain without doing anything invasive. And so we look at their memory, we look at their problem solving, we look at their attention, concentration. So we're really able to discern, is this really a cognitive problem? Is this, you know, more depression, or is it dementia, or are there any, you know, kind of smoke before the fire in terms of someone that we can really predict, like, we're seeing something here that it's not, you know, dementia now, but, you know, I think if we don't do something, it could turn into that.
I call it a brainoscopy. I tell my patients, go see Dr. Locke and get a good, complete brainoscopy.
That's right. I don't like that word.
Okay. Well, the patients can relate to it.
A brain health checkup.
Yeah, they can relate to it.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah, and it is. It's preventative. And so we put all those pieces together and then come up with a personalized brain health plan for each individual person. And that could, you know, look a bunch of different ways. It could be maybe it is a medical intervention that's going to make the most sense. Maybe it is a medication that's going to make the most sense.
Right.
Maybe it's some supplements. Maybe it's, you know, behavioral treatment for insomnia, you know, or something different than that. And definitely we always, you know, talk about diet, you know, lifestyle, those types of things as well. Or maybe it's all of the above, mm-hmm. and we try to really present it to patients in a way that's doable and approachable.
All right. You know, one of the things I emphasize at McMinn Clinic is an advanced prevention approach. And so how does the concept of prevention apply to brain health? And for those who already have disease, when is the best time to begin treatment?
Yeah, I think back to what we had already addressed, you know, now is the best time, you know, regardless of your age. I think if you're old enough to contemplate having a brain, you're old enough to take care of it. And I know, you know, my kids are 8 and 10 and we're not dogmatic or anything like that, but just teaching them that what you put in your body, you know, not only matters for, you know, how you grow, but also for your brain functioning. And so I think, you know, starting out prevention is key. I had, after the TED Talk on Saturday, I had a few millennials standing in line to talk with me, and they came up and asked what they could do to help with their brain health.
Wow.
And I think
cool.
that is
wow.
just so fantastic, you know, and they're, you know, it's just like simple little healthy habits. So yes, in answer to your question, I think prevention is key, but it's never too late. And I think also early intervention, there's a lot of, you know, complementary things mm-hmm. that you can do in terms of diet and lifestyle.
Beautiful. You know, Dr. McMinn, you've taught me three things that are important for people as we age, and that's that we're able to see, we're able to ambulate, and we're able to think independently. And I know you alluded to that initially, Dr. Locken, just this idea of independence. And all three of those things, ambulation, vision, thinking, and thinking so important. Our brains are critical. So what did you tell those millennials? How do we keep our minds sharp?
Yeah, I think so we came up with the brain health intervention. And so as with any good thing, we have this acronym, you know,
great.
And the H stands for healthy eating. And so I think the biggest part of a brain healthy diet may be what you eat, but it may be what you aren't eating. So really getting rid of processed foods. We know that sugar is just so dangerous for many different things. And there's actually research out there that has described dementia as type 3 diabetes, where the insulin receptors in the brain are just unable to take up glucose. So avoiding, you know, high sugary beverages and foods. And I think for millennials, that's kind of a hard thing to do. For kids, it's a
yes.
hard thing to do. It's, you know, at every get together, it's, you know, and I think, you know, not being dogmatic about that, like maybe that 80-20 rule, but,
right.
you know, we're not doing it as a, you know, as a now and then thing. It's several times a day when we are putting sugar into our bodies. So thinking about that, I think, is really important. But then also thinking about what you are putting in, nutrient-dense, anti-inflammatory foods, mostly like leafy greens, colorful vegetables.
Yes.
Berries are high in antioxidants, and then wild-caught fish and things that are rich in omega-3 fatty acids are really healthy for the brain.
That reminds me of that purple sweet potato you had the other day.
Yeah.
I've never seen a purple sweet potato.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
a superfood.
It is a superfood.
I'm currently pregnant, for our listeners who can't see, but the other day I had a organic sugary drink that it's not normally in my regimen. And I immediately, within about 20 minutes, felt my little girl just jumping around like a jumping bean. And it was such a strong illustration.
She was saying more.
She will
love
do that
what
when
it
she's
does to your body
as well.
I just realized, wow, if it's doing this to her, what is it doing to me as well? It was just a really powerful illustration for me to see that immediate effect. Because a lot of times we don't see that the you know, okay, I'm going to have half of this cupcake right now. Yeah, and right. We don't see the immediate effect of it, but it's that additive, like you said, the 80-20 rule is a beautiful one to apply that gives us a lot of freedom to not be legalistic about our diet, where yeah. we're 80% of the time mm-hmm. eating the best choices we can, but that 20% of the time we allow the leeway. And that allows us to not feel like, well, I already messed up, so throw out everything right, else. I'm right. just going to have 10 more cupcakes. So yeah. you'd be like, yeah. no, that's my 20%. So it's yeah. a really powerful rule that you shared there. I love that one.
Yeah. I must admit, we're a bad influence on Lindsay around the office. Yesterday, we had a little shower for her baby. And one of our staff members, I won't name her, brought in some cupcakes, and they were
wonderful. Gluten-free, cupcakes.
Loaded with sugar.
Not sugar-free, yeah.
And Lindsay definitely had her share. So anyway.
I did.
Well, all right. Well, Dr.
So
Locke,
that H was healthy eating, though,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so we're back to our acronym.
And I won't, belabor all of these. The E is emotional regulation, and mm-hmm. so we know that that can have a big impact on brain health. And then A is activity and leisure, and that can cover so many different things: joy, purpose, meaning, human connection, sleep, exercise. Like, how are you spending your time? What are your days like? And there is tons of research to show even those with joy, purpose, and meaning in their life were 4 times less likely to develop dementia. That was a study out of Rush. And mm-hmm. so, I mean, these are all really important, just foundational things to do. L is learning strategies, and I think we all have heard, do some crossword puzzles, that's going to protect your brain. And, it can't hurt. But really what we're finding is that you want to really learn a new skill or, discover an old skill that you had, kind of dust off that ukulele that you have in your closet
right.
and play it, or do things that are just kind of making your brain communicate in a different way, and that really provides a buffer against cognitive impairment. And then T is for toxins, and I know your listeners sure. know all about that, mm-hmm. But the general population really is starting to understand that even the products that we use on our bodies and to clean our homes and just the pesticides on food, air pollution, all those things, you don't want to live in a BPA-free plastic mm-hmm. bubble, but you need to be aware. And there are certain things you have control over and certain things that you don't. And these things do lead to brain issues. Mm-hmm. And then the final H in brain health is for habits. And I think it boils down to that. You can know all this, you can be very knowledgeable, but if you're not incorporating it in an easy way in your days, then it just kind of gets lost. And so kind of, bookending your day. Do you have a simple morning routine? Do you have a simple evening routine? If you do that every single day, it will make a difference.
Interesting. Well, Dr. Locken, please speak to the issue that dementia is not just about old people, but in fact, subtle and important changes can begin many years before we recognize dementia.
Yeah, I've taken a deep dive into the literature recently, more in terms of like the brain scans, and it's actually pretty, I guess, a little bit frightening that our brain scans are showing that there are changes associated with Alzheimer's. So there's the amyloid plaque and the tau can be present in our brains when we're in our 40s and 50s before any type of cognitive issue even presents. And for those with a higher genetic predisposition, they're actually finding it in adolescence and early adulthood. And so I think there is definitely, again, like more of a smoke before the fire. And then there's generally a span of 20 or more years between when those changes start to show in the brain to where they actually start to appear as are the, central memory impairment, things like that. And so because of that, I think that gives us a real window of opportunity to really prevent the brain issues and to, know that there are things that we can do to decrease our risk. Another really interesting study showed that inflammation markers when we're in midlife, so in, 40s and 50s, predicted dementia 20 years later. And so again,
wow.
like just getting at those inflammation markers is going to really make a difference in terms of your cognitive health later on.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Inflammation is such a root cause that we talk about that I word a lot.
It is.
Yes.
So when we start to, when y'all start to recognize things looking like dementia with a patient, what are some of those early intervention modalities that would be employed?
Yeah, I think one of the hugest things that we focus on is lowering of inflammation, and that can be done through a variety of different mechanisms. One big thing that we do is recommend, you know, beautiful supplements that are going to be really helpful for that. But diet can really lower inflammation.
Yes.
Meditation, you know, yoga, you know, stress reduction, sleep, all those things, you know, serve to reduce inflammation. And I think that's the most powerful thing that we do in terms of helping with brain health issues.
You know, Dr. Locke, it's really been interesting to me over the years working with you. We'll get these people in and we'll test these things called biomarkers, which are the labs we look at that have implications for dementia and disease. And we'll see things, especially like the C4A, which is a nonspecific marker of inflammation. These people come in and it's huge. And then we get them on the right diet. We get them on some targeted supplements. And wow, they just come down and it's profound how much they improve with these measurable, objective biomarkers.
You probably recall one of our patients. She came in very secretly from her conventional doctor family. She didn't really want her husband or her son, who were, you know, physicians, to know what she was doing. And we, you know, she did the biomarkers, and we found her C4A level was sky high, right. Like super high. And she said, well, I'm not going to do any supplements. I'm not really going to do anything else. She was already exercising and had that as a part of her life. And she increased her sleep, you know, hygiene a little bit more. But the only other thing she did was she incorporated the Whole 30 for 30 days. She's like, okay, I'll follow that. Wow. She came back in after 30 days because she just wanted to see if it was helping, and she just ran her C4A level, and it dropped dramatically. Yeah. What, it was like 9,000 by 9,000, and she was in the normal range.
That's right.
So it was really diet alone. And so, yeah, how powerful. And it's so cool to watch those biomarkers drop and, you know, and really, you know, we're not doing these Herculean efforts. I mean, it is a constant effort, but they're kind of small daily changes that people are incorporating kind of step by step. Yeah.
That is a beautiful story.
I wish you would shout that from the rooftops.
Yeah. And I think, you know, in the first patient or two, you say, whoa, is this really real? But when you see them patient after patient after patient, and they come back and these biomarkers are better, then that is pretty good evidence that these people are going to have a better outcome down the road.
Yeah. And not everyone can do everything. Well, no one can do everything. Right. And so even patients who are pretty overwhelmed with just caregiving for dementia or just getting by with dementia. So they haven't really done tons of changes, but we're still seeing improvement in biomarkers. Like, it's really pretty cool.
Yeah. Speaking of overwhelming, I remember when we first got started, we did turn to Dr. Bredesen for some good information. And I read his book several times, but I think when you read the book and you close it, you can feel overwhelmed. You look at some of the protocols these people are on. And so I think one of the things we try to do is to customize the program for each patient and try to simplify it and make it doable. Because I think I would rather have people follow 50% of the program than just give up and follow none. So I think trying to simplify it and not overwhelming people is important. And I think of the sort of the things we do, the one that has the highest priority is diet. It's what you put in your body. And I preach that on the McMinn Clinic side and also on the Brain Health Institute side. And of course, that speaks to my pyramid of wellness, which y'all have heard me talk about many times. And if you need a reminder, just go to our website or go to Google and just look up pyramid of wellness under images. But I consider these to be the foundations of good health. And so, Dr. Locken, what would you say are the foundations of optimal brain health? And on the flip side of that question, what are some of the root causes of dementia?
Yeah, I think actually that's a beautiful illustration, your pyramid of wellness. I think, you know, it really encompasses all those things. And so what's good for physical health is good for brain health. And so following those principles is really going to reduce risk of dementia, or, you know, slow the progression of memory issues, things like that. So it's a very similar thing. The things that can contribute to brain health issues are things like cardiovascular disease, insulin resistance. As we talked about, stress is huge. Stress increases cortisol, which directly attacks the hippocampus, which is the memory center of the brain. And we see that those with high levels of cortisol actually have shrinkage of the hippocampus. And if you lower that, you can actually have dendritic growth in the hippocampus. So I think that's really powerful. And then, you know, other things that we're finding in our clinic through looking at the biomarkers, homocysteine is one of the most powerful ones that correlated with cognitive impairment. And so that's a biomarker. And then also vitamin D is really, you know, falling out in the literature is one of the powerful predictors of protecting brain health. Those are a few things, anyway.
Great, thank you.
Beautiful. So we've alluded to this a little bit, but we talk a lot about gut health, and we've done a podcast, multiple podcasts on gut health. And Dr. Locken, you even kind of mentioned gut health earlier. So we know that there's this gut-skin connection, gut-autoimmune connection, gut everything, it seems like, connection. So let's talk about the gut-brain connection. Tell us more about that and how y'all address that at BHI.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's the vagal nerve that's going to be the connector between the gut and the brain. And what we're finding is that if your microbiome is unhealthy, it's going to affect every aspect of your body, including your brain. And so if someone comes in with obvious gut issues, that's usually our first line of protocol is let's fix the gut. Is it SIBO or SIBO issue, which is small intestinal bacterial overgrowth? Is it, you know, something in terms of not digesting foods? I mean, you can eat the healthiest diet, and if you're not digesting those vitamins and minerals, it's really not going to be helpful to your brain.
Right.
And so I think that's really, we look at that as the first line of defense. Like, we have to protect the gut, fix the gut before we really do any other types of interventions. And you can do that simultaneously, but we definitely have that as a core focus.
Wonderful. Okay, Dr. Locken, please tell us about the Alzheimer's gene. When somebody comes in and they have the undesirable genetic mutation, does that mean they're destined to get the disease, or can the patient modulate his or her risk with lifestyle changes?
Yeah, I think that's, you know, it's a beautiful question, but it's a very, very complex question, and I don't want to put all the listeners to sleep or scare anyone. And so let me try to address it. So there is early onset familial Alzheimer's disease, which is very rare. Estimates range from 1 to sometimes, you know, like 5 or 6% of Alzheimer's patients have that. Recently, there was just a very courageous family who put their story in the Homewood Star locally about having this very rare early onset familial Alzheimer's disease. In that case, it's very strongly a genetic link. That doesn't mean that the way that you live your life doesn't have an effect on how rapidly that the symptoms might appear, but it is a much stronger genetic link. But for the rest of us, the 95% of us, there's another genetic factor that we look at. It's called the ApoE genetic allele, and there are two different copies. You get one from your mother, one from your father, and each one has either a 2, a 3, or a 4, and with those you have higher risk. So someone who has one copy of the ApoE4 is going to be at higher risk. If someone who has two copies of the ApoE4 is going to be at even higher risk. And then with a 3-3, that's kind of not increased risk or decreased risk. And then the E2 is going to be actually a protective factor. Now, that's different than the early onset familial genetic, where this is the ApoE is a genetic predisposition. It's not fate. And so if we look at that in terms of it puts you at higher risk, but you can actually diminish that risk through what we call epigenetics, or how you live your life, or doing protective things like these lifestyle variables, you can actually, you know, determine whether or not that plays out in your life.
Yeah, and I think it's important also to just point out that even if you have the sort of the good variation, E3, E3, mm-hmm. that doesn't mean you're off the hook,
right.
That you still need to do these other things. You can still get Alzheimer's disease even though you mm-hmm. have the desirable genes.
Yeah,
The leaky, okay. Back to the leaky roof analogy. Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
It could be a different
hole. And especially we're seeing some of our patients who we have done genetic testing on and found out they had the E2, which should be a very protective factor. Mm-hmm. These patients have been exposed to tons of toxic chemicals. Mm-hmm. One was Chinese drywall, and then, tons of like industrial exposures, and they have bona fide Alzheimer's, where both have been, you know, have gone through a PET scan showing that they have beta amyloid in the brain. So there's something else. There's more to the story. It's not just genetics. Mm-hmm. So both in terms of protection and in terms of risk.
What is your philosophy about, should most people get their APOE genes tested just to find out or not?
I think it's such an individual question.
To
me, and for me, I feel like it's an empowering thing.
I think so too.
Yeah, I've seen both ways with our patients who want to mm-hmm. get it done, mm-hmm. and most of them do. If they're, you know, coming to our clinic, I think that's kind of one of the most important things. But those that have a high family risk, and then they find out that they don't have the APOE4 allele, it's kind of a relief. They know that they're not off the hook. They're already doing these healthy behaviors, but it's like, Now you know, okay, good. I don't have that gene. You know, that's a sigh of relief. And then those who have discovered that they have had one copy or two copies, I think it's, a call to action. It's really like, right. How vigilant do I need to be about this? And if I have two copies, I better be pretty vigilant about this. And mm-hmm. maybe I shouldn't follow 80-20 rule, or, mm-hmm. you know, maybe it should be more 95% of the time. Mm-hmm. I need to be
right.
very on target with the things that I do. So for me, I feel like it's an empowering thing, but it's really up to each individual, and some people don't want to know, you mm-hmm. know, and honestly, you don't really have to know if you are living your life in a healthful way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. You know, in my previous chapter as a regular doctor, drugs were the main tool in my toolbox, and I still use them now and then when needed. But please comment on the success rate of pharmaceuticals in Alzheimer's disease.
Yeah, I think I touched on that before.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we're just not seeing any real beneficial effects.
Yeah.
There have literally been, you know, hundreds of failed clinical trials. I think we're at like 245 or 246. There was a recent one where the pharmaceutical company, pulled the plug on the study because they just weren't seeing results with it. So there's really no medication that can appreciably slow or stop the neuropathology of Alzheimer's disease, and we really aren't seeing one in the foreseeable future. I think UAB has a couple of prevention studies going, but again, it's going to be several years before these types of medications are out. So currently, there's not much. There might be some benefit for some people with the current drugs that are out there. However, if you're not really seeing benefit within the first 3 months, it's unlikely that it's really going to be helpful. And the studies have shown at most it really delays nursing home placement by maybe 3, and the most I've seen is 17 months.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just so that we're all on the same page, Dr. Locken, could you help us understand that difference between dementia and Alzheimer's and just those terms?
Yeah. So it's, I'm in my little world of, neuropsychology. And so I forget that sometimes, people don't really know what the difference is. And actually, they're really interchangeable, because dementia is an umbrella term. And the term is used to describe a decline in mental abilities that is severe enough to interfere with daily functioning. And I think that's the critical part, that, you know, everyone has like some brain fog or, you know, forget things now and again, but is it interfering with your ability to really participate in your daily life? Are you unsafe in some way? Are you unable to carry out, you know, those normal activities of daily living? Do you need assistance? And that's the definition of dementia. So that's the umbrella, but there can be many, many things under that umbrella. Alzheimer's just happens to take up 2/3 of that umbrella. So it's the most common type of dementia. And so when we say dementia, usually people are really kind of using that interchangeably with Alzheimer's disease. But there are other types of progressive dementias, such as frontal temporal dementia, which presents a little bit differently. It's usually like more behavioral changes or impulsivity or maybe inappropriateness in public as the presenting feature, and then later might have like memory problems, where Alzheimer's is the presenting feature is memory, and then later you might have behavioral issues. There's also vascular dementia, where there's a lot of tiny little strokes happening all over the brain that can lead to, you know, initially like mild cognitive impairment, and then if you keep on having them or have a major stroke, that can lead to a dementia. And then even something like a traumatic brain injury, if it's severe, you can have dementia related to that, dementia related to Parkinson's, dementia related to MS, you know, so there's a ton of like different little things, but Alzheimer's is 2/3 of that umbrella. So okay. It's really the most common one. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I'm guilty of that too. I often use the term interchangeably, even though I know very well there's mm-hmm. a lot of different dementias mm-hmm. that are out there.
You know, one thing that's really touched me over the years over at the Brain Health Institute is the level of tender, loving family and partner support that so many of these patients have. It seems like this is really important in the patient's ability to optimize his or her care. So, and it also seems like more so than many other conditions I see, it takes a village when it comes to dementia.
Absolutely. Yeah. Getting a little bit emotional because I just am so honored mm-hmm. to work with the patients that are there. You know, it takes someone who has a different way of thinking to mm-hmm. come and seek this out. And we are seeing some love stories.
Yes,
I mean, for both the couple that comes in to prevent together. I mean, what mm-hmm. a commitment mm-hmm. to your partner that, mm-hmm. hey, you know, I'm going to take care of myself so you don't have to take care of me is really the underlying thing that they're saying to each other. Wow. And then, you know, we've also seen really these, you know, high school sweethearts who have been together 50 plus, 60 plus years, and now the love of their lives, mm-hmm. you know, is declining in front of their eyes, and they will do anything yes. to help them. Right. And if you have... if you are symptomatic, if you do have memory problems, if you do have, you know, this interference in daily functioning, you can't carry out this program alone. You need, you know, help. And we've had some family sessions where we've given, you know, duties to each of the family members. Okay, this is your job. You go, you know, order these types of things. And this is your job. You're going to make the brain health smoothies and deliver mm-hmm. them to mom every day. And mm-hmm. then this is your job. And it does. It takes a village. But then it happens. And they, and they stabilize or they get a little bit better. And the other thing, too, is that the biggest comment that I've heard from families is that they're more interactive with the family. Like they're taking mm-hmm. part in things. Whereas before, I think when you start to have a memory problem, you know, it's scary, it's embarrassing, and you kind of start to really disengage. There's some social isolation, which is the worst thing you can do when you have cognitive issues. And so we're seeing this re-engagement and this, you know, the family all on the same team, all on the same page, and everyone really, you know, working together.
Oh, that's great. So when you look at this sort of the tidal wave of baby boomers and dementia and do the financial math, this disease could potentially bankrupt our medical system.
Yeah.
So as a society, what do we need to start doing to prepare for this burden that's going to be placed on our society and our healthcare system?
I think we need to take a different approach because mm-hmm. the way it's going, there is no way we can have the financial resources mm-hmm. to support, you know, the statistics. And the statistics are that currently there are 5.8 million Americans, just Americans, and this is a global problem, mm-hmm. living with Alzheimer's disease. The estimated direct costs are... at $300 billion per year. And that's just direct costs. We're not talking about, you know, nursing homes. We're not talking about, you know, your daughter has to quit her job because she has to come and stay with you during the day. I mean, these are all the indirect costs. Mm-hmm. that aren't even added to that number. And the projected figures are estimated to triple by the year 2050. And as wow. I think about that, I'm thinking about how old I'm going to be in 2050. Yeah, right. I mean, this is real. I'm going to be right in the middle of, you know, those around me and hopefully not me, you know, struggling with this. So it's really not that far away, and that those numbers are just, you know, astronomical. Mm-hmm. We have to take a different approach.
Yeah, we do. It's kind of scary when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
What are some books or resources that you'd recommend to patients or families?
So one of the ones that we've referred to and that we really kind of used as a foundational book is The End of Alzheimer's by Dale Bredesen. Mm-hmm. But I agree with you. I think it's more of a clinician primer. It's mm-hmm. complex. It's complicated. I can see like someone reading it or starting to read it and just feeling like, oh my goodness, this is just like so mm-hmm. overwhelming. But it is, it's a first step in really thinking about this problem differently. Other books that are out there are David Perlmutter's work, mm-hmm. His Grain Brain, and Brain Maker are really good resources for that. Can you think of a couple of other ones?
Well, you mentioned Dr. Walls earlier. It's W-A-H-L. Yes, right. Yeah. I just want to clarify that. And what's the name of her book? I read it years ago.
The Walls Protocol.
The Walls Protocol, right.
Yeah,
right.
And that's a beautiful, I think that one's really more tangible, like with things that you can actually, you know, incorporate in your daily life.
And it's an amazing story. So just for the story itself, it's worth reading. But she has a great spin on diet, and her personal story is very touching. So
resources. Sorry to interrupt. Mm-hmm. A new one that's out is Lisa Moscone, and hers is Brain Food. And I love that book. That was really, really good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right.
So how can our listeners learn more about you and about BHI, or how can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, and so we're trying to get more on social media. So we are actually on Twitter now.
Awesome.
And so we're also on Instagram, we're on Facebook, and starting to do a little bit more with that. And that's, I'm really excited about that because I just love the education piece. So we're going to start a blog and things like that. And then our website is BHIBrainHealth.com. Okay. And they can email us directly from that as well.
Well, Dr. Lockett, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to come visit with us today. This is a topic of huge importance. And once again, it's been such an honor to work with you over these years. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Lindsay.
Thank you for being here.
Well, that will about do it for this episode of the Functional Medicine Podcast. Thank you for joining us. We hope we were able to share some information that was valuable to you. And we want you to check us out. Come visit us at mcminnclinic.com or functionalmedicinepodcast.com. Or if you want to call and make an appointment, just call area code 205-868-1313.
And take a moment to rate us on iTunes so other people can find us. That's how we get out there. And big shout out to Ben, Ben Wedland. He's our recording engineer who makes everything happen for us. So thank you, Ben.
And now, Coach Lindsay, can you leave us with a final pearl of wisdom?
Oh, thanks, Dr. Rinkman. You know, I think what stood out so much to me today was just that H for healthy eating and just that powerful story about the patient that went on the Whole 30 for 30 days and just saw those results. So I think if we take anything, you know, be empowered with what you're putting in your mouth. You make so many decisions every day. Our two podcasts ago, we talked about the 17 meals a day where we're 17 times choosing what's going in our mouth. So hopefully we'll narrow down that choice and do more like 3 or 4 times a day. But just the power is in your hands to make and change your brain in a powerful way. And prevention is key. So I loved hearing those lessons from you, Dr. Locken. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, and speaking of healthy eating, I wish y'all could see the visual here of Lindsay's smoothie here that she has here. This is the kind of stuff she comes in with every morning. So, Ben, could you take a picture of that and post it on the website so people can see it? So, Lindsay, what's in this smoothie?
Well, when I used to work in the hospital, I would have it up on the desk, and a lot of people would think it was a stool sample.
Yeah. it looks like mud to me.
Oh, my goodness, that needs to go to the lab. What is that doing? It's got cacao in it, along with some other superfood powders. It's got bone broth protein, some good fats in it, like hemp seeds and chia seeds and coconut oil. So try to get a nice balance as well with some greens vitamins, powders too in there. And of course, berries, which you mentioned are so great with their antioxidants. So try to get it all in. That's one of my, it's like my multivitamin of food that helps me make it all, get all down.
That's going to be one healthy baby you have.
Lord willing, that's the prayer.
That's right, that's right. Well, that should wrap it up. This is Dr. McMinn.
And this is Coach Lindsay.
Take care and be well.